VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Over the past couple of months, scientists have made some remarkable discoveries that have provided unique insight into our solar system and universe. Among these findings include a possible giant ninth planet that resides in the outskirts of our solar system, the brightest, most powerful supernova or exploding star ever seen, and the possible presence of one or a number of universes that exist outside of our own. Today, we'll talk with some of the scientists who made these remarkable discoveries. My first guests today are astronomers and planetary science professors Konstantin Batygin and Michael Brown from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. The names of these two gentlemen may sound familiar to you, and that's because they have recently created a buzz of excitement all around the world after they found evidence of a giant planet traveling in an odd and drawn-out orbit in the far reaches of the solar system. If confirmed, the newly found planet would be the solar system's ninth planet. Pluto had that honor until it was demoted to a dwarf planet status back in 2006. Mike, based on the information you've gathered, can you give us a description of this Planet Nine?
So it's amazing how much we know about Planet Nine, even though we haven't seen it yet. We have only seen its gravitational influence on the outer solar system, but we know a lot about it. We know, for example, that it is on this very distant orbit that takes 10 to 20,000 years around the sun. We know how close it comes. It comes about 20 billion miles away from the sun. It goes as far away as 100 billion miles away from the sun. And all of these things we've been figuring out just by watching its gravitational influence on the outer solar system.
Konstantin, you know, for decades, a number of astronomers have been looking for a mysterious planet called Planet X out in the far reaches of our solar system. Do you think that Planet Nine is the legendary Planet X?
Well, there's good historical context for this. The existence of Neptune was calculated before it was found, and interestingly, prior to the successful calculation of Neptune, there was also quite a bit of speculation about it for almost 50 years. So there was quite a bit of speculation, and there was this one successful calculation. So what we're hoping is that the evidence that we're working with, unlike the previous situations where the data had turned out to be spurious, is actually the first real hint of the planetary catalog of the solar system being incomplete. And we have good faith in this. In the data that we have now, we can statistically calculate the chances of it being fake, and in effect, that clocks in at about one part in 10,000. So we're pretty sure that we're on the right track.
I understand that this discovery was made by using computational and mathematical modeling and simulations and not direct observations. Mike or Konstantin, one of you can answer this. What I'm really curious about is what was it that even led you to explore the possibility of Planet Nine's existence?
Oh, it all was spurred by a scientific paper that was written 2 years ago by an astronomer who used to be a postdoc with me here at Caltech, Chad Trujillo and his colleague Scott Shepard, and they noticed that in the outer part of the solar system there were some weird alignments of things, and they didn't really understand why. They proposed, as is kind of typical when you see something kind of strange in the outer solar system, they proposed that there was a planet out there, and we looked at their weird alignments and realized that their proposal didn't work. The planet that they suggested was there didn't cause the effects that they saw. And I think most people sort of discounted their entire study because of that. But I know these guys, and I know that they were smart and knew what they were doing. So we went and looked more closely at their alignments and realized they had missed some of what's really going on. What's really going on was not these kind of obscure alignments. What was really going on is that the whole outer solar system is being pushed around by something, and that was the moment we started down this road of trying to figure out what is pushing around the outer solar system.
So you're thinking that the gravitational pull of Planet 9 might be what's causing all this action in the outer solar system?
That's, in fact, the only way we know that it's there is because its gravitational interactions is causing all this to happen.
Let's get back to the computational and mathematical modeling that and simulations we were talking about. Constantine, can you give us an idea of how these work and how would something like a computer or mathematical simulation lead you to this discovery?
Well, in effect, these computer models are aimed at generating synthetic solar systems. Right, we put in all of the necessary physics into a big computer code, basically, and use a supercomputer to generate realizations of the solar system. So what would the solar system look like today if it had an additional planet on such an orbit? It's really through these types of what's called forward modeling, where you try to make the solar system and then compare it with the data that you're presented with, that we're able to kind of zoom in on the correct orbit for Planet 9.
Yeah, so the trick that, Constantine never really talks about how many of these ridiculous models were run, but the trick is to run a model for every possible configuration you can think of. And how much computer time do you think it used overall at the...
On a supercomputer, this thing ran probably for over half a year, and this is what this means is that if you were to run it on your laptop, it would literally take millennia to complete. So a supercomputer is we have one in the basement of the very building that we are sitting in at the moment, and it literally takes up about half the floor.
One thing that we seem to not hear too much about until recently, I guess, is what is actually going on in the outer solar system beyond Neptune. Can you give us an idea of what we do know about the outer solar system, and especially the Kuiper Belt?
Yeah, so the Kuiper Belt, it's been about 20 years since we've really started to explore the Kuiper Belt in detail, and the Kuiper Belt is this band of icy bodies out beyond Neptune. Now, it's sort of reminiscent of the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, which is this band of rocky bodies. But these are primarily ice, or ice and rock, and they're bodies that are the largest ones. They're like Pluto and Eris, but they go down to as small as we can measure. Right now, we know of something like 2,000 bodies out there out beyond Neptune, and Pluto is part of this band of bodies out there, and for most of the last 10 years, ever since the demotion of Pluto, if you had asked me, is there anything else out beyond the Kuiper Belt, I would have told you, well, the Kuiper Belt ends somewhere just outside the orbit of Pluto, and there might be a few more kind of big things out there, but there's certainly no more planets out there. We didn't see any reason to think that there was something else massive out there. But what we found is that when you look at the Kuiper Belt in detail, the very outer edge of the Kuiper Belt are being pushed around by something, and that is the connection between the Kuiper Belt and Planet 9.
Tell us, if you can, Mike, a little bit about this wild and elongated elliptical orbit of Planet 9, 10 to 20,000 years to make one full orbit of the Sun. How were you able to determine that?
These are the sorts of things that you can only tell by doing this massive number of computer simulations and looking at the effects of different planets in different positions. And it turns out that we can tell how close it comes by the fact that when it's closest, when it's at something like 20 billion miles away from the Sun, that's when it really does all of its interaction with the inner part of the solar system. So we can kind of realize where that is. So that's about 20 billion miles where it's closest. And then the furthest approaches are a little bit harder, but we can give it a range of how far away it is based on how successful our computer simulations are with these different ranges.
And a final question, gentlemen, direct observation of Planet Nine. I understand that you're fine-tuning your models and your simulations and that plans have been made to start scanning the skies in hope of directly spotting Planet Nine. Can you tell us about these plans? And especially what I'm curious about is how will you know where to look?
Yeah, so we actually have been, and we started looking a year ago, in fact, as soon as we were fairly convinced we knew what was going on. We started looking, even though we hadn't finished and we didn't know exactly where we were supposed to look yet. We started looking a year ago. We're refining it, refining where to look now. And the way we know where to look is, again, by all of these computer simulations. We realize that Planet Nine has to be tilted to the plane of the solar system, to the other planets, by about 30 degrees. We can figure out where that tilt is. We know where the orbital path of Planet Nine is. So the search is going to be along the path of Planet Nine. We don't have it precisely pinned down, so we still have to search a fairly broad region. But it's bright enough that we can see it from some of these biggest telescopes on the Earth. So we are, in fact, just next month headed off to the Subaru telescope on the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which is really going to be the premier telescope in the world for doing this search. And we're going to keep on plugging away at different parts of the sky.
Congratulations once again, Constantine Batygin and Mike Brown. Thank you so very much for taking the time out of, I'm sure, your very busy schedule right now to talk to us about this amazing discovery.
Thanks very much, Rick. Our pleasure.
That was Constantine Batygin and Michael Brown from the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're talking about outstanding astronomical discoveries that have been made recently. Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. Joining me in this next segment is Benjamin Shappi, a Hubble Carnegie Princeton Fellow at the Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, California. Benjamin is a member of a team of astronomers who have been observing a fascinating cosmic event taking place some 3.8 billion light-years from Earth. According to the scientists, it's the most luminous and powerful supernova in the universe. Ben, first, tell us, what is a supernova?
A supernova is actually the explosion of a star. So the most common type of supernova comes from a very massive star, a star that's about 8 times the mass of our own sun or greater. And it goes through its life, and what these stars do is they actually burn hydrogen into helium for energy in their core, and then they burn the helium to carbon, and they keep going. They keep burning to heavier and heavier elements until finally they get to iron. And once they get to iron, they can't burn iron to produce any more energy. So at this point, you have this massive star with a whole bunch of weight pushing down on the core, but there's no support. So what happens is the core actually collapses. When it collapses in on itself, there's something about the mass of our sun. It collapses down to a neutron star, which is incredibly dense. It's about the size of a city, of any typical city here, you know, in the world, but the mass of our own sun. And so just like if you drop a hammer or some other object on the floor, when you drop it, it releases energy. And when the core collapses, it releases a huge amount of energy. And this energy then couples with the envelope, the rest, the 7 solar masses or more of material outside the core, and actually blows that material outward. And so that's the type of object that we see as a supernova explosion.
Are there particular categories of supernova according to luminosity?
So there's a couple different ways that astronomers classify supernovae. So I just described to you the most common one. There's other supernovae which are more luminous, which actually come from different progenitors, and those are called type 1A, which are very interesting objects on their own, but aren't really a part of this story. And then there's even more luminous objects that astronomers call superluminous supernovae. So these are 200 times more luminous than the brightest normal type of supernova.
Now, regarding this particular supernova, as you mentioned, Assassin 15 LH, can you tell us about it and its discovery and what makes this particular starburst more special than others?
The story of Assassin 15 LH really starts with the Assassin survey, which is the all-sky automated survey for supernovae or Assassin. And this is something that myself and my thesis advisors at Ohio State University first created. And this survey basically surveys the entire sky, both in the northern and the southern hemispheres, to look for things that change on the sky by taking repeated images of every patch of the sky. And so in June of this year, we actually found, or in 2015, we actually found a new source appear that looked to us to be like a normal supernova at first, just in our data. But then when we got follow-up data from the DuPont telescope at Las Campanas Observatory, we actually saw that it didn't look like anything like any of the other 200 supernovae that we had found until then. So this got us really interested. And the next question you want to know is just how luminous this supernova is. So we got more data from the South African Large Telescope, which actually then told us that this object wasn't only bright to us here on Earth, but it's actually very far away. So just like a light bulb or some other light source, if it's right next to you, then it's very bright. And then if it's far away, it gets dimmer as it goes into the distance. If something is bright to you and is very far away, then you know it's incredibly luminous. And this is exactly how the story unfolded for Saturn 15LH, is that we found that it looks very bright here on Earth in our telescope, but then also we found that it's very far away. So this put it into a luminosity class of its own. It's actually more than two times brighter than the previous brightest supernova that we've ever seen.
Some interesting stats concerning this particular supernova. It's bright as 570 billion of our own suns and some 20 times as luminous as the entire output of the stars of the Milky Way galaxy.
That is correct. It's mind-boggling just how luminous this object actually is.
You and your colleagues at Ohio State University said that the object at the center of the supernova might be a magnetar. So what is a magnetar, and how would it affect the performance of a supernova?
So a magnetar is basically a neutron star, which I described earlier, which is something, an object which is the mass of the sun but the size of a typical city. But the difference between a normal neutron star and a magnetar is that it has a very strong magnetic field, and it's rapidly rotating. And so this allows you to get an additional energy source, because if you can tap into that rotational energy through these magnetic fields, you can actually then generate more energy and produce a more luminous supernova. The problem with this model of attention, it's not clear yet if it's a problem, is that this Saturn 15LH is actually right on the edge of just how fast you can spin a neutron star and then get that energy. If you took a neutron star and spun it as fast as it possibly could without having to just rip itself apart, the energy that it takes to spin that neutron star is about the same amount of energy that we see coming out of a Saturn 15LH. And so this being right on the edge of this energy threshold is what makes this object so interesting.
Is it true that the object is a mere 16 kilometers wide?
So the neutron star itself is about 16 kilometers wide. The object that we're seeing, the outer layers of this star, are much larger at these times.
They also say that if it indeed is a magnetar that's powering this supernova, it is so powerful that it pushes the energy limits allowed by physics. Can you explain this?
Basically, the magnetar can only spin so fast before it actually just would break itself apart. And so the energy that it takes to spin the magnetar that fast is the exact amount of energy that we see. Or is very close to the amount of energy that we see coming out of Saturn 15LH. And so this is the tension that we're talking about. So maybe it's not clear that, and that's if you're 100% efficient. So that's if you take all the energy from the magnetar and put it all into the luminosity that we see. And it's not clear how you would do this. So in science, and especially in astronomy, typically if you find an object that's right on the edge of a model, and that's often a sign that maybe your model is wrong in some way, or maybe it's a completely different object altogether.
Why do you personally think that the discovery of Saturn 15LH is so important?
So I think, supernovae, as I described earlier, are important in the universe and in general for, in the story of how we got to be here as human beings today. And often in science, by studying the most extreme objects of a class, you can learn more about the entire class as a whole. In this case, especially the superluminous supernovae. So I think by finding such an extreme object, it'll help inform us to figure out what's actually going on in these objects, which are, critical for our universe to be the way it is today.
Are you involved with any follow-up study with the supernova?
Yes. So we're doing many different studies not just my team, the Assassin team, but also other groups of astronomers as well. I'm particularly involved in a couple different approaches to try to figure out exactly what's going on with this object. So one approach that we're taking is we're getting observations with the Hubble Space Telescope. And this will allow us, so Hubble Space Telescope has very high spatial resolution. So it's like if you took an image from the ground, like a blurry photograph, and then all of a sudden it was crisp and clean. That's what it's like to get data from the Hubble Space Telescope. And so this will allow us to see exactly inside the host galaxy where the supernova is. Additionally, we're following up this object with the Swift Space Telescope, which allows us to see UV ultraviolet light, which you can't see from the ground. And this thing, this object is extremely hot, so it actually emits most of its energy in the UV. So following Assassin-15LH in the UV is necessary to understand how it fades with time. And the reason we're so interested in how it fades with time is this helps us glean even more information about this object.
Ben, thanks so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you very much, Rick. It was my pleasure.
That's Benjamin Shappi, a Hubble Carnegie Princeton Fellow at the Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, California. Is it possible that there is another or maybe even a number of universes besides our own? Our final guest on today's program is Ranga Ramchari. He's a project scientist and project manager at the European Space Agency's Planck Space Telescope Data Center at the California Institute of Technology. He says that he may have found evidence of an alternate or parallel universe, or perhaps even multiple universes that exist outside of our own. Mr. Chari made his findings while he was working on a map of the cosmic microwave background, which is thermal radiation left over from the Big Bang that formed the universe about 13.5 billion years ago. I guess we should start with a definition of parallel universe. Just what is a parallel universe?
Well, I prefer to use the term alternate universe. So a parallel universe would be something which is coexisting with our universe. So it must have lasted at least 13.8 billion years, which is the age of our universe. So an alternate universe is something which has completely different physical properties than our own, and it could last for a much shorter time. It could be 1 year, 10 seconds, 100 seconds, some random number. And so I prefer to use the term alternate universe to refer to universes which have different physical properties.
Now, I understand there's been quite a bit of debate between traditional physicists and quantum physicists as to whether or not there was ever a Big Bang and that our universe is not finite, as some think it, but infinite. Your thoughts?
That's a valid debate. The reason we think science is a matter of taking data and trying to interpret the data with a theory. The evidence for the Big Bang, or something like the Big Bang, is relatively strong because what we see is a relatively constant radiation coming from all patches of the sky. And this was discovered way back in the mid-60s. And this is the cosmic microwave background, which is the relic radiation from the Big Bang. So we know that something like the Big Bang happened, which produced this radiation that's all over the sky. But why our universe has specific properties, such as why is the number of baryons or why is the number of protons what it is a question we don't know the answer to. Is it just a random number? In which case, there could be many other universes with a completely different random number of the amount of matter in it. So that's why we think that maybe each universe has its own Big Bang, and we're only seeing the radiation from our own.
And that would lead me to my next question for you, is when we speak of a possible parallel universe or many universes, are we talking about real physical entities or something that's just a dimension of time?
Oh, no, we're talking about real physical entities with matter in them.
Would a parallel universe follow the same physical laws of our universe, or would they perhaps have their own version of physical laws? And if they do, what would be some of the possibilities?
I mean, we don't have the data right now to test the physical laws in other universes. Heck, we're barely at the point at which we're trying to find these other universes. But in theory, those other universes would have completely different physical properties. Some of them could have the same physical property, but the majority would have completely different physical properties. So the gravitational constant would be different, the fine structure constant would be different. All these numbers would be just random numbers which are particular to our universe and different in other universes.
This parallel universe you think you may have gotten a peek of, is it in our current universe? And if not, what separates the two universes?
Well, it's very hard for the data to be explained by what we see in our universe. What we see is a lot of brightness at a particular frequency, while it should be dominated by noise. It should be pure noise. So the fact that there is a lot of brightness at a particular frequency suggests that there are parts of space which have 4,000 times more matter than what we know in our universe. And that's very hard to explain by what we see about the remaining properties of our universe. That's why we think that if this excess brightness is coming from hydrogen, then it must be due to another universe bumping up against ours.
I think we need to step back a little bit, Ranga, and get a little explanation of what exactly it was that you noticed that led you to believe that you were taking a peek at a parallel universe.
We are analyzing data from the Planck satellite. Planck is a joint NASA-ESA mission, with ESA being the lead contributor and NASA having a small contribution to it. And it's a mission which mapped out the entire sky at frequencies which we cannot see with the human eye. It's the third-generation mission, and after COBE and WMAP, which were two previous missions. And as a result, it provided the sharpest, clearest view of the sky. When we analyzed the data from this mission, it took the maps of the entire sky at 9 different frequencies. When we subtract out all the components of a mission, such as our galaxy, the dust in our solar system, stars, other galaxies, galaxy clusters, once we subtract all of those out, we're left with the radiation from the Big Bang. And by studying the properties of the radiation of the Big Bang, we see that it's in certain patches of sky, it is too bright at a single frequency. And that's the frequency at which hydrogen lines, which result from protons and electrons sticking together in the distant universe, can be detected.
Ranga, I know some physicists, quantum physicists, try to explain universe, multi-universe, parallel universes in terms of bubbles. They use the universe as a bubble. So using the bubble analogy here, is there a possibility of a physical collision with a parallel universe? And if this is possible, what kind of effects could it have on those of us here on Earth?
Well, it would have no effect on us on Earth in any way, because this is happening way back in cosmic time. And probably the other universe doesn't even exist because it has physical properties which don't allow it to exist for 13.8 billion years. I mean, in terms of significance to mankind, I think of it much like what our view of the Earth was in 300 BC, where all we knew about was, we didn't know about North America, South America, Australia back then. We just knew about little parts of Asia, the northern tip of Africa, and the European continent. But, you know, when we come to 1700 AD, we suddenly know that there are 7 continents. And so maybe our vision of our current universe has been the same as what it was in 300 BC, where we had a very good understanding of the immediate vicinity. But I use the word immediate kind of loosely because we're talking about a very vast piece of volume. And by finding other universes, we're actually finding other continents.
As you made this initial finding, how do we get closer to the truth of verifying this?
The signature is right at the limit of the current data. In some ways, it's like looking for color in a black and white picture. So we have analyzed the data in great detail to try to extract some color from a black and white picture. And in reality, Planck was not the ideal mission for this, but we didn't know that we were going to be looking for this when the mission was designed. So I think a future generation mission, which actually obtains color in multiple frequencies, will help us pinpoint what the origin of this emission is and even what the physical constants in this alternate universe are, if it is indeed arising from that. So I think progress in terms of building a space mission takes a while. So I anticipate that it would take 10 to 15 years to actually robustly confirm this with a next generation mission. But in the meantime, we can probably use ground-based telescopes which operate at similar frequencies to beat down all the other systematics that we have from our galaxy and from our solar system and so on.
Ranga, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
Thank you very much for your interest. It's been fun.
That was Ranga Ramchari, a project scientist and project manager at the European Space Agency's Planck Space Telescope Data Center at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California. And that's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.